We now have a new challenge, perhaps the most monumental in recorded history. The opportunity to investigate a phenomenon that could change our destiny. A look at ourselves 1,000 years in the future.
We're going to examine and perhaps question some widely held theories of what may have happened to this Earth of ours. We're going to investigate some strange and bizarre events in the present. Unbelievable happenings as fresh as today's headlines. And more important, perhaps, we're going to take a searching and scientific look into the future. We're reaching more and more out into space. Perhaps, as we may learn, someone, something, somewhere in space is reaching out to us.
Who the visitors are, where they're from, and what they want is unknown.
Bigfoot was attracting national attention and was now rapidly becoming the most intriguing mystery on the North American continent.
Many people have seen ghosts and reported incredible experiences from the realm of the spirit world. Who can tell what this young man will see as he falls deep into a trance?
Welcome to After Dark Radio and your host, Ryan Alvarez.
And here we are, everybody, After Dark Radio. It is March 7, 2014. On the Dark Matter Radio Network. We got quite a show for you tonight. We're going to be joined for the first time ever by Linda Moulton Howe. I got like 30 years worth of questions to ask Linda Moulton Howe. I think I first heard her, I don't know what year it would have been, but obviously she's been on Art's show about a million times. And her website has been around since 1999, earthfiles.com. And I got a lot of questions for her. We got her on the show here today. She's everywhere. Coast to Coast AM, she was on Art's show, I believe she's on Ancient Aliens. Everybody listening to this right now, I'm sure, has heard of Linda Moulton Howe. So she's going to be on the show in about a half hour. It's going to be a good time. And obviously a lot of stuff to talk about. In fact, the earthfiles.com website, if you want to go up right now and check it out, that was originally the handiwork of our illustrious webmaster, Keith Rowland. So he helped launch earthfiles.com. And it is still up right now. It's still being updated. If you want to go up there and check that out, you're welcome to do that. So she's going to be on in about a half hour. And in the meantime, we are here live, as we are every Friday, on the Dark Matter Radio Network, 11 o'clock p.m. Pacific, 2 a.m. Eastern. And we've been taking your phone calls for a while. We're going to do open lines. I've got a bunch of interesting news articles to read here today. So if you'd like to give us a call, you're welcome to do so. 855-478-4478 is the phone number. If you'd like to contact me via Twitter, if you don't want to call in, you're welcome to do so. My Twitter handle is at Brian Alvarez, so make sure you check that out. And emails as well. I take your emails, brian@wrestlingobserver.com, and make sure you put After Dark in the subject line, and we'll read as many of those as come in tonight. It's a two-hour show here. Linda's going to be on in about a half hour, probably go about an hour with Linda. And then we'll take some more phone calls and emails later on in the evening. So again, the email, brian@wrestlingobserver.com. Make sure you put After Dark in the subject line. And you can tweet me as well, at Brian Alvarez. And we will be monitoring all of those throughout the evening. Now, a couple of websites of note. Obviously, artbell.com. You'll want to head up there and see what's going on. Our website as well, afterdarkradioshow.com. You head up there, we've got all sorts of things. If you need the phone number, if you need the Skype line, if you need the email address. In fact, if you want to be on the show, there is a link up there for producer Garrett. You can contact him, and he will set you up to be on the program if everything works out. So our producer Garrett's email is up there as well if you'd like to be a guest on the show. Our Twitter feed is up there. We've got a replay of last week's show. And I recommend right now, while you're listening to this, if you did not hear last week's show with Seth Shostak, I recommend going up there right now, because when this show is over, about 10 minutes actually after the show is over, I will go up there and I will replace that show with tonight's show. So if you want to get a chance to check that out, if you're not a subscriber to our WrestlingObserver.com website, and subscribers at the website have a full archive of every show I've ever recorded dating back to 2005, talking our wrestling shows and everything. All the After Dark shows are all up there. If you don't want to, if you're not a subscriber, you've got about a week to get every single one of these shows after they air. So go up right now and get the Seth Shostak episode. It's an excellent episode. And again, later on tonight, I will put up this episode on AfterDarkRadioShow.com. Also on the left-hand side of the page, we've got a lot of stuff up there. In the news, we've got a lot of different news articles we're going to go over here today. But again, the first half hour will be about you, your phone calls and your emails and your Twitter messages. So give us a call at 855-478-4478. We've got a couple of emails, actually. And Keith here has sent me a link to a YouTube video about an island where you may want to go for your next vacation. Now, I haven't clicked this yet, but you know how the YouTube, in the email, there's a preview of the YouTube video. And I don't know what that is, but it very much looks like a haunted doll. So maybe during one of the breaks here tonight in between the Linda Moulton Howe interview, I will go up there and check that out. But that actually is looking like a it's looking like an island I'm not going to go to. And this here as well, this is from Andrew. Brian, I've been investigating this urban legend for a long time. I fully believe, he says, that Paul McCartney died in 1966 and was replaced by a lookalike. There are certain unexplained differences between Paul McCartney before 1966 and after 1966. He says here, this website details some good information on the subject. He's got it here. It's definitely something to think about. And he's got this article. Maybe I'll tweet it out here. I actually had not heard the urban legend of Paul McCartney dying and being replaced in 1966. But I did read something the other day. I think it was on the Anomalist site. Let me see if I can find it right here. If you've never been to the Anomalist site, it's actually a really good website. For those of you out there that are listening that have wives, if they're fans of Ellen, you can go up there and there's actually an article linked up. I'll read here in a second from The Nation about Ellen DeGeneres' mansion is apparently haunted. So you might want to head up there. So anyway, this is The Art of Dying. This is from the Daily Grail. It's not Paul McCartney, but it is another Beatle, George Harrison. And it says here, in my book, Stop Worrying, There Probably Is an Afterlife, I devote an entire chapter to the fascinating topic of end-of-life experiences, which incorporate a number of phenomena that occur in the final days and hours of someone's life. These include experiences of the dying, such as deathbed visions, but also a number of perplexing cases that involve quite healthy people close to or caring for the dying person. One such ELE is the dying light, where those caring for the dying have described seeing a bright light surrounding the person as they pass away, exuding what they relate as a raw feeling of love. Surprisingly, reports of the dying light are not rare. As I pointed out in Stop Worrying, neuropsychiatrist Peter Fenwick was amazed to find in a survey of palliative carers, I guess these are end-of-life carers, that one in every three reported accounts of a radiant light that envelops the dying person and may spread through the room and involve the carer. In a similar Dutch study, the numbers were even more staggering. More than half of all carers reported observations of this light. And again, this is from dailygrail.com. It says, after my book was published, I came across another high-profile example of the dying light. Olivia Harrison, the wife of former Beatles guitarist George Harrison, gave this account of his passing from the Martin Scorsese-directed documentary about his life, George Harrison, Living in the Material World. There's actually a video here. I'm not sure if it'll play, but let's give it a shot.
There was a profound experience that happened when he left his body. It was visible. Let's just say you wouldn't need to light the room if you were trying to film it. You know, he just lit the room.
So that right there is Olivia Harrison, the wife of George Harrison, former Beatles guitarist. And it says here that her testimony sounds very similar to Peter Fenwick's description. A radiant light that envelops the dying person and may spread throughout the room and seems befitting of the passing of a man who was very interested in mysticism, consciousness, and being personally prepared for our own death. As Harrison himself put it in one of these songs on his 1970 solo album, All Things Must Pass, "Nothing in this life that I've been trying could equal or surpass the art of dying." So that is from dailygrail.com. If you want to head up there and check that out. And this here from The Nation. Ellen DeGeneres' mansion is haunted. My wife is a huge fan of Ellen. And a lot of her friends are as well. So if you've got a significant other that is a big fan of Ellen, you might want to point them to this. This is from The Nation. It says, Los Angeles, Ellen DeGeneres is having problems at home with a ghost. I guess there'd actually been some, the tabloids are reporting that her and her significant other are having serious issues. Portia, I believe is her name. The talk show Titan, it says here, who hosted Sunday night's Academy Awards, recently moved into a $40 million mansion and is convinced it is haunted by its original owner, who died there in 2009. The house had been remodeled, so Ellen thought it would have no trace of the former owner, a source told the National Enquirer, but she was wrong. Within a few nights of moving in, Ellen started hearing random noises, including footsteps and doors opening and closing. Then in the middle of the night, she heard a woman's faint cry. Ellen is totally freaked out, it says here. She hasn't had a solid night's sleep since she moved in. She said she's never been a believer in ghosts or spirits, but she doesn't have any explanation for the mysterious sounds and voices of the 13,000 square foot mansion. Yes, 13,000 square foot mansion was built for real estate developer Sidney Brody and his wife Frances in 1951. It's located in the exclusive Holmby Hills neighborhood next door to the famed Playboy Mansion. Brody died in 1983. His wife, a renowned art collector, passed away in the house at age 93 after a long illness. After her death, the investor purchased the home and completely remodeled it. Ellen then bought the nine bedroom, eight bathroom, 13,000 square foot mansion in early January. As Keith said here, imagine the power bill. It was a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity that Ellen could not pass up, said the source. It isn't every day in your life that you come across a 13,000-square-foot mansion with nine bedrooms and eight bathrooms. Ellen said she's convinced the noises and voices she hears are Francis Brody's, and Ellen thinks Mrs. Brody's spirit can't bear to part with the house even in the afterlife. Friends have convinced Ellen to conduct a spiritual cleansing ceremony in the house. She doesn't want her new home to have any bad energy, and she's not going to share it with Francis Brody. That's a big house. That's from The Nation. So as you're all probably well aware if you listen to this show for a little while back we did a show on Bitcoin. Bitcoin's been having some problems of late. A lot of problems. We may have to have our guests back on to talk about what's going on with Bitcoin. This here from ABC News. This is not good. This is not good for Bitcoin. Tokyo Bitcoin Exchange files for bankruptcy. The Mt. Gox Bitcoin Exchange in Tokyo filed for bankruptcy protection Friday, and its chief executive said 850,000 Bitcoins worth several hundred million dollars are unaccounted for. The exchange's CEO, Mark Karpeles, appeared before Japanese TV news cameras, bowing deeply. He said a weakness in the exchange's systems was behind a massive loss of the virtual currency involving 750,000 Bitcoins from users and 100,000 of the company's own Bitcoins. That would amount to about $425 million at recent prices. The online exchange is unplugging earlier this week, and accusations it has suffered a catastrophic theft have drawn renewed regulatory attention to a currency created in 2009 as a way to make transactions across borders. This is not good for Bitcoin. Debts at Mt. Gox totaled more than $65 million, surpassing its assets, according to this data bank, which monitors bankruptcies. No one recognizes them as a real currency, said the Japanese finance minister. I expected such a thing to collapse, he says. So there you go. Not looking good for Bitcoin. They talked to a Tokyo resident, Roger Ver, who has provided seed capital for Bitcoin ventures such as blockchain.info. And he said that the Mt. Gox people were likely sincere, but had failed to run their business properly. Mt. Gox is a horrible tragedy, he says. A lot of people lost a lot of money there, myself included. I hope we can make, I hope we can use this as a learning experience. So there you go. Not looking good for Bitcoin. It's the After Dark Radio Show, everybody. My name is Brian Alvarez. We are here for 2 hours every Friday night. In about 15 minutes, Linda Moulton Howe is going to be on the show. She's got a lot of stuff to talk about. A lot of stuff to talk about. And we shall see where it goes. I've got, as noted, I got about 20 years worth of questions. I've been listening to Linda since the first time I ever heard on Art Bell's show. I don't know when she started an arts show. Probably, you know, obviously the mid-90s at some point. But I have listened to her forever. I listened to her when she went on Dark Matter. And a lot of different things to talk about. I'm sure she's going to want to talk about cattle mutilations. That's how this whole thing started for her. And if you want to check out her website, it is up there at earthfiles.com. So head up there and check that out. The phone lines are also open if you want to call 855-478-4478. That is 855-478-4478. If you would like to give us a call on any topic, anything we are talking about, or more. Previous show here was talking about the fake moon landing. What do you think about the moon landing? Did it really happen? We did a show on this once, and I had a lot of people trying to convince me that we did not go to the moon. And I will say that nobody did a good enough job to convince me. I believe we went to the moon. But a lot of people have tried to claim that such a thing did not happen. So maybe if you think you've got a good argument, a compelling argument, you can give it to me. I always look at things, I always look at it in the Occam's razor. Simplest answer. What is more likely? The fact that the idea that we faked the moon landing or that we really went to the moon? The way I've always looked at it is, When I think about how many people would have had to have been involved to fake the moon landing over decades, and nobody's come forward yet and said, "Hey, you know what? I was holding the reflector. I've got a photograph of it." No one's come forward. So to me, when I think about all of the people that would be necessary to fake the moon landing, I think it'd be easier to go to the moon than fake the moon landing. So if you think you can convince me, you're welcome to call or any topic. It's up to you. 855-478-4478. Lines are open. I have noticed, by the way, I don't know why this is, but I always open up the phone lines at the beginning of the show, which is 2 a.m. Eastern. And for some reason, nobody calls. But then later in the show, when it's 12:30 in the morning on the West Coast and 3:30 in the morning on the East Coast, all of a sudden everybody's calling. I don't know why that is, but that happened. Somebody has sent me this on Twitter, at Brian Alvarez. This is from Phil. CEO of Bitcoin Exchange found dead in Singapore. The American CEO of a virtual currency exchange was found dead near her home in Singapore. The police spokesman said Thursday that initial investigations indicated there was no suspicion of foul play in the February 26th death of 28-year-old Autumn Radke, meaning officers did not suspect murder. Spokesman said police found Radke lying motionless near the apartment tower where she lived. Police have so far classified the death as unnatural, which can mean an accident, misadventure, or suicide. Future of Bitcoin has been under scrutiny since the collapse of the Mt. Gox exchange in Tokyo last month. I think it had been in under scrutiny for a lot longer than that. She had worked at other tech companies, and a funeral for her was held Wednesday in Hales Corner, Wisconsin. So there you go, CEO of a Bitcoin exchange, found dead, age 28. But they are saying officials do not suspect murder. I want to read this. This is from the New York Times. The mammoth cometh. Bringing extinct animals back to life. It's really happening, and it's going to be very, very cool, it says here, unless it ends up being very, very bad. And I think it's pretty obvious how this could end up being very, very bad. Jurassic Park, for example. I don't need dinosaurs eating me. First time Ben Novak saw a passenger pigeon. He fell to his knees and remained in that position speechless for 20 minutes. He was 16. At 13, Novak vowed to devote his life to resurrecting extinct animals. At 14, he saw a photograph of a passenger pigeon in an Audubon Society book and fell in love. But he didn't know that the Science Museum of Minnesota, which he was then visiting with a summer program for North Dakota high school students, had them in their collection. So he was shocked when he came across a cabinet containing two stuffed pigeons, a male and a female, mounted in lifelike poses. He was overcome by awe, sadness, and the bird's physical beauty. He has now visited 339 passenger pigeons. He's gone to the Burke Museum in Seattle, the Carnegie Museum of Natural History, the American Museum of Natural History. And I guess the idea is that he wants to resurrect these animals. This is a extremely in-depth article. I'm actually going to put it up during the Linda Moulton Howe interview. I'm going to put it up on my Twitter. So if you want to go up there and check that out, you can read that. And let me know what you think about the idea of bringing back an extinct animal. It's a very controversial topic, obviously, because some would say that if you are attempting to bring back an extinct species, you're in a sense playing God. Now, on the other hand, you could also argue that if we have the capability to do this, why not? I mean, if you want to make the God argument, then if we have the capacity to bring back these animals, maybe God gave us the capacity to bring back the animals, so bring them back. And then obviously there are the non-religious arguments, which are just that, do we really want to bring these things back? Do we really want to mess around? You know, if the ability is there and it becomes widespread, what will people attempt to bring back? So it's a very interesting article. You should check it out. It's up at the New York Times. I've got a bunch of other articles here as well, but we're going to save them, everybody. We're going to go to Linda Moulton Howe. And we're going to discuss a lot of different topics. There's so much stuff to talk about. When we come back, we'll have more news, and I will go through the email bin as well. You're welcome to send your emails to Brian at WrestlingObserver.com. Make sure to put After Dark in the subject line, and we will go through as many emails as we can. Unless, for example, I get about 5,000 emails in the last hour, in which case I will not go through all of them that I get, but I will go through a bunch of them. So Brian at WrestlingObserver.com. You can tweet me at Brian Alvarez. And when we get back, after the Linda Moulton Howe interview, we'll take your phone calls as well, 855-478-4478. While you're listening, check out ArtBell.com and Dark Matter Radio Network, as well as the After Dark Radio Show website. So much stuff up there. We'll get to more of it when we get back from the interview. So with that, let's head to Linda Moulton Howe, legendary reporter, longtime regular on Art Bell and Coast to Coast AM. Should be a great interview. So we shall be back with Linda in just a moment. We are back here on the show. Brian Alvarez here, After Dark Radio on the Dark Matter Radio Network, and we are so happy today to be joined by a legend, a legend. Linda Moulton Howe is here on the show. And if you've ever listened to Art Bell, you've heard Linda Moulton Howe probably a million times, coast to coast, AM, everywhere. Linda, how are you doing today?
Well, thank you very much for having me join you. And I agree with you and others who feel that high strangeness in many ways is some of the most important news on this planet, and that unfortunately it is politically denied by the government, and therefore it is not covered on the 6 o'clock news, even though I and many others think that what happens in the category of high strangeness may have more to do with the past, the present, and the future of what this planet is about than just about any other subject.
I've been listening to you on Art's show and Coast to Coast AM forever. And before we get into all of this stuff today, and there's so much stuff to talk about, you can all, I mean, if you want to get started right now, everybody, you can head to earthfiles.com. And there's so much great stuff up there. But before we get any further, I just want to talk a little bit about your history. I mean, I've heard you forever as noted. And how did you get into the high strangeness field? And when did you first meet with Art?
Well, let's see. You have to go back to, I grew up in Boise, Idaho. I graduated from Boise High School. I guess I was 11th in my class, and it set me up to get scholarships. And I went to the University of Colorado in Boulder, and then I worked for the Idaho State Senator in Washington, D.C. for a year, and realized that what I most wanted to do more than anything else was to be in the world of documentaries, journalism, reporting, and news. And I got a scholarship from Stanford University in Palo Alto to work on my master's degree in communication. And there for 2 years, I was the only girl in a class of 27 guys at Stanford University, and we made documentary films for 2 years. And I went from there to KNBC in Los Angeles, where I was a street news reporter for a year, and then I was hired into the documentary department, and then I was hired to produce a program that moved around between Washington, Sacramento, and California, looking at big issues affecting the state of California. And that set me off very seriously on the path that I have to this day in 2014, and that is, my focus has always been, since Stanford and the documentaries I did there with the Stanford Medical Center and the Stanford Linear Accelerator, science, environment, and phenomena. At the time, I was interested mildly in Earth mysteries, but especially in the context of science and environment and medicine. And then when you jump to the year 1979, 11 years after I graduated from Stanford University, I was hired by the CBS station in Denver to be their director of special projects. And my job was to produce 3 or 4 documentaries a year for television broadcasts on subjects that were in science, environment, or impacts on the state of Colorado, to do news reports, and to do live studio shows before an audience and have sort of subjects that would be debated. And it was in that context that in the late summer of 1979, I started getting calls because I was well known. I was being, my work was always being written about in the newspapers, so I was a well-known category at Channel 7 in Denver. And I would get calls from people on a lot of subjects, and I suddenly started getting calls about renewed animal mutilations, a new wave. And the Denver Post and the Rocky Mountain News and all the media in Colorado suddenly had more photographs, more articles about these strange deaths of, it could be horses, cattle, goats, sheep, rabbits, cats, dogs, and then wild game, deer, elk, marmots, all of them have been affected by the same phenomena. And here is basically what an animal mutilation is. The animal is found usually lying on one side. Occasionally, large steers or bulls are found on their back with their legs straight up in the air. But most of them are on a side. And whichever side they're on, the sky-facing side up toward the sky is the one that has the excisions, almost as if something is saying, look at this. You can't do this, but we can. And what is missing usually is an ear down to the skull, leaving a perfect circle on the skull, or the ear is cut perfectly in half, or the upper third is taken, but it's quite geometrical. Then the eye, usually the entire sky-facing eyeball is removed, and in many of the cases in 79 and 80 when I was working on this, there was a perfect circle of hide removed from around the eye, taking the eyelids, the eyeball, and if you took a protractor from high school and you put it in so that you could trace the circle, you would have a perfect circle where the hide, the eyeball, and the eyelids were taken. Then usually one half of the jaw, meaning everything is cleaned off, down to the bone, down to the teeth. So it is sort of a white, gray half of the face. The tongue in 90 to 95% of the cases of animal mutilations has always been removed vertically deep in the throat so that sometimes you cannot even see the remaining tongue tissue, but it is a vertical cut, not a horizontal cut. Then in the genital area, in the males, it can be only one testicle removed from inside of a sac in which there is no excision to the testicular sac at all. This has happened many times. I've seen it. Or both testicles are removed, or the penis itself is removed, leaving the testicles, or the entire male organ is removed in a very clean, neat, bloodless oval in the belly of the animal. In the female, it is often the entire udder removed in an oval or a square cut. The square cuts are very common. Or the individual teats on the udder are removed in clean, bloodless holes, sometimes only one teat, sometimes four. In about 95% of the females, the vaginal tract is removed in a very clean, leaving a hollow 4 to 8 inches deep. And very often that is combined with the rectal tissue, making a hole that is about 4 to 6 inches wide and protrudes into or excises and removes everything into the abdomen by about 14 inches. In some cases, the tails are cleanly cut through the tail of the tailbone with an instrument that has never been identified because there's nothing that humans have that can do that. And the telltale mark, besides the bloodless nature of the same pattern, is that time and again, and I have been on hundreds of these cases, I've seen this from my own eyes. In Colorado, for example, in the summer or the fall, the dirt is so dry, it is the texture of face powder that women would use with a powder puff. Mm-hmm. Nothing can walk through that kind of powder. Not rabbits, not mice, not anything can walk through it and not leave some kind of a trail. When you have a 1,900-pound steer or a 2,000-pound bull on their side or their back in an area where there's no grass, the body is on this powder, and there is not a track around them for many feet, and there is no track, including their own tracks, what else can law enforcement or any rational mind conclude? That animal was lowered dead to the spot. If it had been alive and there had been any thrashing, you would see it in this powder soil. We're talking about absolute perfection. The animal is laying there on this powder, the excisions that I have just described, no fluid, no blood, everything is dry on dry powder. And one of the most remarkable cases that will bring all this into focus about why law enforcement told me right from the beginning, but they would not stand up in front of my television camera and say these words, Linda, the perpetrators of animal mutilations are creatures from outer space. I heard this from many people. The challenge was to get it on the record so that I could have it reported in my documentary. And one of these cases, I saw approximately a dozen color Polaroid photographs that had been taken by the Logan County Sheriff's Office. It was a steer, large steer, black, and it was found on this face powder dust. And as I'm looking at those Polaroids, the sheriff said to me, "Tell me what you find unusual in these photographs." I was looking at an animal that had the excisions of ear, eye, jaw, tongue, genitals, and rectum, what I said to you, and no blood, no tracks around the body. But the head was laying down or the dropped down in like an 8-inch deep hole. And I said, "Well, how did this happen? What happened? How did this hole get here underneath this steer's head?" And the sheriff said, "That's what we wanted to know. And Linda, the only thing that we can conclude is that whoever did this had the technology, the ability to hold this huge, powerful animal completely without moving while it removed all of these pieces of tissue from the animal while the animal was alive and was paralyzed. There wasn't one quarter of an inch movement where the hooves were in this powder dust. But they said, the sheriff said, whether it was an experiment or whatever they were doing, that head of this animal was able to move while they were removing these parts from the animal, and that's why we think that hole is there. The animal was in agony, could not move any part of its body, and dug the 8-inch hole with its head. That is the place to start for you and for those listening about the, when I use that phrase, high strangeness, that's for openers. I could continue for 3 hours on just the highly strange cases of what has happened with animals all over the world. This is a worldwide phenomenon. And the higher the strangeness, the more often somebody, human, has seen a beam of light come out of an oval glowing disc in the sky. And that is one of the things that you can take to the bank. You're listening to somebody who, at this point in my life, I've interviewed at least 1,000, maybe 1,500 people just in the category of the human abductions and ranchers and law enforcement who have been outdoors in pastures at night, sometimes all night long on night watches, and what they have seen. And in my own files, I have half a dozen cases where people who have been ranchers have either seen a glowing oval in the sky put down a beam of light into a pasture, and they have seen an animal rise in that beam of light into the oval, or in one or two cases, ranchers have been out because of some unusual something happening, or they're doing night watches, and they see a beam come down into their pasture, and to their absolute amazement, they see one of their animals being lowered in the beam of light to the ground. And they are scared to death. In both of these cases, they ran back to their ranch house. They did not go forward. They waited until the sun came up. And they will go back to the pasture where this was occurring. And there is a mutilated animal, the same excisions that I've outlined, no blood. And it's lying usually on its side. And that right there, what I've just described, eyewitness cases. Sheriffs know this. Deputies know this. They've talked to people like I have. And why is this not on 60 Minutes, CBS, CNN, Fox? Because over the last 50, 60 years of this phenomena, human ranchers, deputies, sheriffs, they are more afraid of saying the truth to other humans and being ridiculed. And in the sheriff's case, they don't want anybody to know that they are talking with each other about perpetrators being creatures from outer space, because we're living in a nation that from World War II made it politically incorrect and with punishment to people in military and intel to say anything about the truth. We're not alone in this universe. We never have been. And extraterrestrial biological entities from other places in the cosmos have been interacting with this planet for thousands of years. And one of the interactions is taking tissue and fluid from Earth's life for reasons that we can speculate about, but we cannot prove.
So when you went in and investigated some of these, because you've mentioned that you've personally gone and seen a lot of these mutilations, is it, I mean, obviously a percentage of those have got to be, it's a natural death, predators, you know, went to work on the body and that sort of thing. I mean, I presume what percentage would you say is a that gets reported to you is a natural death as opposed to clearly some high strangeness is going on?
I understand the question. And I guess what my mind, the wall I'm hitting is, I have seen so many natural predator deaths. I have studied so many Department of Agriculture books on what natural predators such as cats and bears do to cows and horses and so forth. There is no comparison. The predator, the natural predator kills of animals are bloody, clawed, the tissue is ragged, even where they have licked tissue so there is not blood falling onto the ground, the tissue looks clawed. When you study for 10 minutes what claws do to the faces or to the sides or to the legs of animals, what predators do, and then you look for 5 minutes at the classic animal mutilations that I have been talking to you about, there is no comparison. There is no resemblance.
So you can tell in an instant.
And so you come in your question to why is it that going back to the 60s and the early 70s, when hundreds, thousands of mutilated animals were occurring, why is it that the public and the media kept hearing about predators, disease, and satanic cults? Because that is what counterintelligence operations in the United States government were ordered to make sure that wherever the truly mysterious, high, strange animal mutilations were occurring, that the phrase, whether it was a disease, predator, or satanic cults, that is what would make the newspapers, that is what would make radio, that is what would make television. And what I've learned as an investigative reporter, I have a hard nose, I like facts, I like evidence, that's what my work is famous for. But I don't close my mind at the first moment that somebody is saying in the newspaper, this is predator. In fact, when I see predator disease or satanic cults associated with highly strange, unusual animal deaths, my suspicion is immediately the government knows that extraterrestrials are involved at that time, at that location, and they will work overtime to make sure that what the media, the general media, is saying is disease, predator, or satanic cults. Now, in to underscore what I'm saying, this is a very, very important part of this whole phenomenon of the last 60 years for you and your listeners to hear, because I know the facts from a veterinarian who was involved in the investigation. Here's what went to the public first. It was spring 1980. It was Benton County, Arkansas. Benton County, Arkansas had been probably over a course of, by then, 20 years, had probably had 200, 300, 400 animal mutilations. And a story gets reported that the Benton County Sheriff's Office paid a rancher for the carcass of a dead cow. And the sheriff's office took star scopes, put the cow out at a pasture, let the camera run all night. Look, ladies and gentlemen, the excisions on the body are foxes. and magpies. And this went across the United States and out into the world as, here's the explanation for animal mutilations. It's all predator. It's always predator. Goodbye. Go away. We don't need to investigate. Meanwhile, what was going on, honestly, behind the scenes the same week that the Benton County Sheriff's Office put out this false story? There was a veterinarian who on that same week examined half a dozen actual mutilated bodies of animals privately and secretly for the Benton County Sheriff's Office. And that veterinarian sought me out to tell me the truth. The veterinarian said that during that same week that the headlines were about predators, that he was opening up the bodies of mutilated animals in Benton County for that sheriff's office. He was finding bladders that had been removed by an instrument he didn't understand because he could not find, it did not look like a scalpel blade. It did not, he did not understand what he was looking at. If it was a laser cut on tissue has a certain look to it, and I showed this in my film, A Strange Harvest, my documentary. I went to a hospital, and I had a surgeon demonstrate electrocautery, laser, and scalpel so that I could compare the cuts. So now this veterinarian is telling me that he is opening up bodies in which there are no excisions on the outside of the bodies. This is such an important sentence. But when he opens up surgically to do a necropsy for the sheriff's department, there is missing bladder, missing esophagus, missing, there were other organs. I think it was a missing pancreas. There was all this stuff inside of these animals, and he did all these reports. They went to the Benton County Sheriff's Office the same time that the sheriff was on television saying that it was predators and that they were showing that with the Stariscope, why. Now, behind all of that is a United States government intelligence operation under orders to make sure that wherever animal mutilations are occurring, that no one like me, Linda Howe, is going to be able to get facts and report them. And apparently that's why the work that I was doing in Colorado was such a shock, that when I started producing an hour special for Home Box Office in 1983, I was told at Kirtland Air Force Base in New Mexico on a meeting where I was to get information about an extraordinary exchange with extraterrestrials at a military base in Ellsworth Air Force Base in 1978, I was going to try to flesh out that story for Home Box Office. And a meeting was set up for me at Kirtland Air Force Base by Peter Gerson, a New York attorney who had been the very first lawyer in the United States after the Freedom of Information Act was passed to take on the CIA, NSA, DIA, NRO, all the alphabet soup. And he was representing citizens against UFO secrecy, known as QFOS, and its head was a police officer on the East Coast who knew for himself in the investigations that he was doing that we were dealing with craft, beams of light, various kinds of high strangeness, and that police officer is the one that hired this attorney to go after the intelligence agencies to get whatever documents they had on UFO investigations. And this one extraordinary case came up. He had me set up this meeting for me to go talk with an Air Force Office of Special Investigations agent named Richard C. Doty at Kirtland Air Force Base, who was to give me some background on this case. And instead, when I came, was ushered through all these punch lock doors and in this building on Kirtland Air Force Base into an office, one of the first things this AFOSI agent said to me was, well, you sure broadsided the U.S. government on that TV show you did. And I, what? Yeah. And he said, yep, they never expected any credible reporter to ever take on that subject. That's quote unquote. Well, by 1979,
well, basically, I mean, aside from you,
when I started on what became A Strange Harvest, I had been producing documentaries, news, live news stories, edited news stories, live studio shows since I graduated from Stanford University in 1968. So I had been an Emmy Award-winning, Ohio State Award-winning, I had lots and lots of awards, which is not said for any other reason, but I have always been and am now a mainstream science environment investigative TV producer and reporter. That's my life. That is my work. And I had been doing it for 11 years before I started on A Strange Harvest. So the government didn't expect that anybody like me would ever take on animal mutilations. My answer, whenever I'm asked that, is how could anyone who cares about the planet they're on and the mysteries that surround us every day turn away from animal mutilations because they think that they're repulsive or eerie without trying to find out what is going on? Because mutilated animals, and I am a person who has been to hundreds of cases, they are pristine, bloodless, and often trackless. That means that they are eerie. They're not repulsive. They are eerie. And in my life, I could never turn away from investigating an eerie animal death because I think we should be paying attention to what is happening on planet Earth, especially if law enforcement and the military people who have talked to me off the record are correct. We are dealing with extraterrestrial biological entities, more than one type. There's apparently political conflict even among the intelligences interacting with our planet. But there are whole swaths of segments of profession on this planet that know, and they've all bought into, this is a policy of denial. You will lose your pensions. You will be put in prison. Your families will be hurt if you talk. And so the truth is always kept suppressed and has been since at least World War II. And if the truth be told, if you went back 5,000 years to Mesopotamia, now current Iran, Iraq, and you went to the cuneiform and all of the carved in stone and brick reports in cuneiform about what was happening there between the so-called Sumerian gods and the roly-poly humans, every person that I know who has inside knowledge in our government says the Mesopotamian so-called gods were extraterrestrials living with roly-poly Homo sapien humans, and the so-called gods were not gods, they were extraterrestrials.
When you've talked to people off the record about this story here, I mean, my question is, if an extraterrestrial biological entity is or a number of them obviously are responsible for these mutilations, has it ever been explained to you any sort of theories about why they apparently take the animal, mutilate the animal, and then instead of disposing the animal, disposing of it in any, I don't know, taking it with them or disposing it, where they return it? I mean, is there a reason it is returned?
Yeah, it's the perfect question, and it is the first question that anybody who starts to seriously investigate animal mutilations always asks. Sheriff Tex Graves in Logan County, in my very first meeting with a sheriff in September of 1979, he said to me, Linda, we knew on the basis of that powdery dust with no tracks, however this animal got here, it didn't do it on its own volition. And what else can we conclude but it's being put down from above, right?
It's being returned.
Okay. The very next question after that, Sheriff Graves looking right at me said, if we're dealing with as they called it then. This was the law enforcement phrase in 1979, creatures from outer space. We've advanced enough to 2014 to call them extraterrestrial biological entities. They called them creatures from outer space then. He said, if they have the ability to take these animals up out of pastures and mountaintops and all over the place, and they can lower these animals down onto powder dry dust and nothing around those bodies, Linda, they don't have to put them back. Why are they putting these animals back? Right back to the same pasture where they were lifted. And I remember that what hit me, and I said to Sheriff Tex Gray then, well, I would say that meant they were kind of flaunting their ability. And he said, that's right. That's what we concluded. We're dealing with something that wants us to know. They want us to see. They want us to find these bodies with excisions on dust that they know that we humans cannot do.
What do people theorize is the reason behind this? I mean, is there something that they need? Is it purely to send us a message? Why do these mutilations occur?
Right now at earthfiles.com, my news website that I have been producing, writing, directing, and editing since 1999, so it's in its 15th year. Right now, I have part one up called Hall of Mirrors with a Quicksand Floor.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason why I have decided to do this right now in March of 2014 goes right to the heart of your question. I've been at this since September of 79. So that means I'm starting my 35th year of trying to get to the bottom of what extraterrestrials are here. Why are they here? What are they doing? What is the agenda? Why the animal mutilations? Why the human abductions? Why crop circles? Why all kinds of things? Why do they do what they do? And the issue of the Hall of Mirrors with a quicksand floor becomes my own personal metaphor for this reason. If you look down a hall of mirrors, everybody has done this. You see all of these reflections. That piece, it's like a piece of a reflection and a piece of a reflection. It goes on to infinity. But who's to say which one of those facets of reflection is the original reflection of who is being reflected back? And when you get to the extraterrestrial phenomena, and you have people in the abduction syndrome, and there are thousands of them, and you, in one abductee, a human says they are abducting people and they are mutilating animals because they handle humans and animals differently, but they're looking for a toxin on this planet that's going to end up killing everything. So they are environmentalists, and they don't want us to explode bombs, and they are very upset with what humanity does to this planet. Okay, that's one big theme in the human abduction. Now let's jump over to another big theme.
But they're friendly.
It's very important to have this juxtaposition. That next set of people will say, I was put aboard, and they had a cow, and they had it hooked up to tubes, and blood was coming out of the cow. It was very neat. It was like a laboratory. But what is standing there? Not grays, not blondes, standing up alligators. And these people in the human abduction syndrome say the standing up alligators communicate telepathically that they use the blood and the tissue that is taken for food. Now you've got that scene. Now, let's jump to a third. Cimarron, New Mexico. A mother and a son, 1980, in the spring. They are driving. They see blonde-haired men in strange plaid jackets. And what's made her stop? She's hearing a cow bellowing, screaming. and she sees these men with blonde hair down beside the animal, and she realizes that they have some sort of an instrument, and they are excising something from the animal while it is screaming. And then she and her son look up, and here is a huge silver disc, and the next thing they know, they're being transported. They go underground. They go underground, and they are end up in a place where there are pools of what appears to be some sort of a fluid. She interprets that in the fluid is blood that has been taken from the cow. But remember, what she saw were blondes. So you've got grays in one category having to do with environmental toxins. You've got standing up alligators in another having to do with using earth life for food. You have another in which you have a mother and son that end up underground where there are vats of some sort of a fluid with what appears to be some kind of animal blood in it, and she gets the impression that the extraterrestrials immerse themselves and that there is sustenance through skin, not through mouths, as we know. And I could continue going on variations and saying, depending upon years, abductees, countries, all kinds of variations, you get various explanations. And therefore, from an investigative reporter's point of view, where you want hard, consistent facts, you're in a phenomena in which there is no consistency beyond the physical evidence of all these animals around the planet in two hemispheres has been going on for at least 100 years, probably longer. That the human abduction associated with beams of light in which people are conscious of going up in beams of light and being returned in beams of light to cars, bedrooms, backyards, pastures, boats, and so forth, is a huge swath of human experience. And then you have the eyewitnesses, usually ranchers, some law enforcement, who have seen that same beam technology used to lift animals and lower animals. This is all fact. But the disconnect with, we'll call it, the politically manipulated world, where there is a strict policy of denial about all of this that's going on, is why the vast majority of people do not understand this is real, this is serious, and a handful of us, like me, have tried very hard to get the facts and report them.
Now, going back to something you talked about earlier, the one of the mainstream explanations for this, you mentioned disease and animals and satanic cults. Now, I was always under the impression that in the in like the mid 70s and in the early 80s, I mean, satanic cults were blamed for everything. And have you ever really investigated the satanic cult phenomenon? I mean, did this really happen? I mean, they talked about, like, the animal mutilations, abductions of children. I mean, was there ever anything to that, or was that an urban legend?
Oh, no, it's definite. 1986, I think it was, I get a phone call from a detective down in San Diego, California. He says that he's been hired by the San Diego County Sheriff's Office to work on a series of... There had been human murders, there had been animals, all kinds of stuff. And he was working with the sheriff's department. He said, I've seen some of your work, and I would like to know if we fly you down here. We're doing a three-state meeting between investigators in Arizona, California, and I think it was Nevada. And he said, we would really like you to bring some of your best cases in the animal mutilations, and we'll all have a meeting, and we can share all of our notes and photographs and videotapes and everything, and maybe we can all learn something. So they flew me down, and I'll just try to do this in bullets. The sheriff, I think, there in California said, Miss Howe, would you please lay out your folders and files and photos? Let's look at that first. And I had brought like 10 or 12 of the best, and I laid them out. and the sheriffs and the detective, they very silently looked at everything I had laid on the table. They didn't say anything until they were done. And the sheriff came over to me and he said, "Miss Howe, I don't think what you have and what we have are the same." He said, "I'm reluctant to show you. This is very troubling. It upsets most people. But," he said, we told you that we would show you a comparison." I said, "It's all right. I've been exposed to a lot." So they started laying their cases out on the table. And my God, you can't, blood in geometric patterns, blood in flu, blood. Mine, pristine, clean, a satanic cult, all kinds of blood and bizarreness beyond belief. Now, they said, "We want to show you the one case where we know that it involves a cow." And Miss Howe, this is pretty stiff stuff, and we're warning you because most people can't take this. And I'm not going on the air. I'm not going to give the details. I'm going to say, they showed me, it seems impossible that humans could do this. But the only part I'm going to share is that they used the carcass of a dead cow in which every internal organ had been removed, if you can grasp this. So it looks like a cow, right? And they hang it in a vertical position, head down, but there's nothing inside. And then it involved the pouring of gallons of blood through it. Mm-hmm. Now, that is the world of satanic cults. Animal mutilations are nothing like any of it. They are the opposite: pristine, trackless, bloodless. So the satanic cult scares people. The name, the words, satanic cult, scares people. That does the work for counterintelligence. It keeps the vast majority of people in the media, they're not going to touch animal mutilations because they don't want to deal with satanic cults. But when you are somebody like me, who I was living in a state where there are hundreds of these cases, going and talking to sheriffs who immediately said the perpetrators are creatures from outer space, I couldn't walk away from that.
Now, we've got about 20 minutes left here on the show. I want to make sure we get into the mysterious booms, the trumpet sounds. This is something, I mean, if you go to earthfiles.com, I mean, you've done a lot of work on this.
Right.
And it's such a weird, I mean, I'll let you explain it to everybody, but just these booms, this trumpeting noise, what is going on?
I think it was, for me, January of 2011. Was the first month that I started getting repeated emails. And so for people listening, every month I get between 4,000 and 6,000 emails. I don't mean spam. I don't mean advertising. I mean it's that much solid, substantive emails coming from all over the planet. I get emails from the south of Australia and New Zealand to Alaska and around to the other side of the world and all over the place. So I'm getting a huge swath section of whatever is going on in people's lives. So when I use that term, January 2011, it's significant to me because it means that it wasn't popping up on the radar. There might have been booms. There might have been sonic booms. There might have been unexplained booms that happened maybe once or twice a year. But I never in my career had a month that started out with dozens of people from various states communicating that their house rattled, sidewalk cracked. What is this boom? 911 is called. Law enforcement is called. Nobody can find the source. For me, it began in January 2011, and I started working on it. Now, throughout 2011, two things began to emerge. The booms persisted, and the first anomaly was I would interview a husband and wife. They both would have heard it, so I've got two eyewitnesses, sometimes a child, sometimes they had a dog who had they were describing, but in terms of witnesses that could talk to me on the phone, maybe it'd be two or three. And I was always saying, well, what about your neighbors? And for the most part, they hadn't talked to their neighbors, so I'm the reporter. I said, would you please go door to door for three or four houses and just see, just inquire if anybody at the same time heard. And they would call me back and say, Linda, this is really weird. This was loud. This shook our windows. This cracked this. This did that. But our neighbors didn't hear anything. Okay, so I'm sitting there listening to this thinking, how is this possible? I don't get this. But then by August of 2011, I had heard that particular, everything, we were shaken, but the neighbors didn't hear it. So I started reaching out to people saying, what kind of physics could focus something that was loud, could be heard by multiple people inside of a house and none of the neighbors outside, and cause all of this physical manifestation in a house? So I started reaching out to people and scientists, and I start realizing that that I'm getting emails from YouTube saying, Linda, there are booms taking place in Austria, but they're also hearing trumpet sounds, or they're hearing scraping metal sounds, or they're hearing this. And that's when, toward the end of 2011, going into January of 2012, is the. In fact, I would say it was January 2012, was the very first time that everybody around the planet suddenly realized that people had been loading up to YouTube sounds that they had recorded in a variety of latitudes and longitudes, and nobody was paying any attention. It was the Kiev, Ukraine, exactly the city that has been in the news for the last two or three weeks as being the focus of such tumultuous, almost like civil war and Russia and all of that. It's Kiev, Ukraine. Well, in January of 2012, there was a nearly 12-minute videotape that a woman, I think it was the ninth floor of her apartment building where she lived, had walked out onto her balcony with a video camera and recorded a sound she didn't understand. And it is the classic trumpet, eerie, sort of melodic. Then that sound, almost identical in terms of the rhythm and the type of metallic sounds, but definitely not Kiev, Ukraine, was recorded by a woman in her house in Texas. She sent it to me. I started getting trumpets. I started getting metallic scraping sounds. I started getting metallic scraping sounds that sounded like that there were people talking in the background, but you couldn't make anything out. And I don't mean like somebody had a microphone and they had people. No, it was like something intimately integrated into the organic sounds, the metal scraping. It was like syllables in human speech. It was very, very bizarre. And finally, throughout 2012, the booms began to replace the new recordings of the trumpet and horns, of which there had been many. And the booms began to suddenly expand where there were reports like Georgia. Five counties simultaneously at the same minute in Georgia were reporting to 9/11, Homeland Security, Fire Department, everybody, five counties. I talked with a police officer. His own garage door was knocked out of its tracks. People had cracked cement. It all happened at exactly the same minute. Never has been explained. And that was the beginning of a trend where instead of a house or house, two houses, it suddenly was multiple counties. It happened again in the Northeast around Salem and Boston, Providence, Rhode Island. Now, as we went in through 2012 to 2013, every province in Canada, almost every state in the United States, we began to start getting these weird booms. So now, last summer, June, I went to Stanford University where I had graduated. I went to the geophysics department. I had read a paper by a geophysicist there, a female professor, specifically about changes on the inner core of the Earth that had never been recorded before, and a whole bunch of consequences they were studying, and I called her up. I went through what I just said to you on the phone, and I said, is there anything in the natural phenomena of the cores of this planet in what you're studying that could explain all of this boom phenomena around the planet? And to my surprise, she said, well, there is a phenomena of infrasound, I-N-F-R-A,
mm-hmm.
that from the inner core that used to be a what they thought was a perfect cylindrical, or, sorry, a perfect spherical iron core embedded in kind of an ocean of iron, and that the central core was spinning, and that it was spinning in that liquid. That's what would set up all the electromagnetic fields of the planet and heat the planet and cause the magma in the outer core to flow up toward the crust and eventually erupts periodically and has for 4 billion years into all the volcanic activity of the planet. She said that they know that there are changes that are taking place. They don't fully understand them. They are studying them all the time. And I said, is it possible, because a whistleblower communicated to me, allegedly for a geophysicist working at Utah, at Hill Air Force Base in Utah for our government on exactly this issue, of booms and strange sounds because of a change in the core of the Earth that is emanating infrasound that is not, you cannot hear infrasound. The human ear cannot hear the frequency of infrasound. Dogs can, however, and dogs have always gone mad and run and gone under beds when mm-hmm. these boom phenomena, usually before the boom phenomena, implying that the dogs are hearing something long before people, and that the infrasound could go up to the crust, leave the crust, go up to the ionosphere that is electrically charged. Then the infrasound bounces back to the surface of the Earth in audible sound. She said that is possible. Suddenly, the idea of a conversion from inaudible to audible that could be planetary, related to the central core changes of the Earth that are not understood, has given me at least a science tool to think about this phenomena. But then it leads to this that feels quite dangerous.
Now, I remember...
Wait, this is the final kicker from the whistleblower.
Okay.
They are studying this because they are afraid. I'm talking about government sources. They are afraid that something is moving into a transition geophysically on this planet. May have happened before, but it never happened when there were 7 billion people on the surface along with animals, in which we could be headed toward a new era of very strong earthquakes, very strong volcanoes, and what the consequences are for Earth's surface life is unknown. That's
now,
a possibility. That is just a possibility.
I seem to recall, I mean, long before the sound of the trumpets and the booms and everything like that, I seem to recall when I was younger, hearing about stories of people that, I mean, maybe it was the same phenomena. They didn't understand what it was. And they would talk about, I'm hearing something. It sounds like it's underground, like there's machinery. I mean, have you heard these reports as well? Is this something completely different?
Underground machinery sounds have been reported for centuries, not explicable. And seems to be completely in a different category. You know, you heard of the Taos hum.
Yes.
The Taos hum is in that category of people hearing machinery. Often they compare it to turbines, as mm-hmm. if they're hearing spinning turbines. The most dramatic case I ever heard, two engineers, left brain as can be, solid professionals out of Denver. This is when I was working as director of special projects at the CBS station in Denver. And they called me up. They said, we just climbed Mount Blanca. We were up on top in a sort of a saddle area at the top. and we were up there looking and thinking how beautiful it was, and suddenly, my God, Linda, it was exactly like a turbine started before our feet. We could feel vibration. We put our ears to the ground. We could hear what sounded like a spinning rotation. We have no idea, but we're saying that there is likely something underground up there. They gave me a map with latitude and longitude. I had other people go up there trying to see if they could hear the same thing. And the people that I knew when I was still at the station, no one ever could duplicate hearing because people went, of course, with video cameras and recorders with the idea that if they got to the same latitude, longitude, and they could record this, then they'd have proof. Then we might be able to hire somebody who could go and dig. I don't know what we'd dig into, but I'm saying that was really part of the sort of, okay, this is what we can do.
Yeah.
Well, if you can't ever reproduce the sound that two engineers, stable, said they heard and did not record, what do you do? And what happens is nobody does anything until there is a repeat. And some places in the United States, there are repeats like Fort Knox and Louisville, Kentucky have probably had as many or more booms over the last 3 years as any place in the United States. No one knows why. And you could say the same thing about the Providence, Rhode Island, and the Boston area, about the region of Tennessee. It's that Tennessee, Arkansas, Illinois, Missouri, Kentucky, right in there. It's just really, really intense. Then on the Vancouver, Seattle in that area, San Diego in California, I can go in parts of Florida. Why? Why is it that this phenomena, it doesn't keep on every day so predictable that somebody can sit there with a video camera and put it on the 6 o'clock news? But it happens frequently enough in kind of rashes of waves to make one wonder, why would, if it were related to a core change of the Earth, why would it manifest in Louisville or Fort Knox, Kentucky for a month, and then be in Wisconsin, and then be in San Diego, and then be in Toronto, and then be in Mexico? That's sort of the way it keeps jumping around.
So I guess the last question on this topic, and we're actually running low on time, from what you've investigated, would you suspect it's a natural phenomenon, or do you think that there is something underground?
That is my question to every day. What am I dealing with here? Am I dealing with a bizarre, and I mean bizarre, natural phenomena of this Earth that we're on? Or is it extraterrestrial doing something on purpose, sort of like the flaunting bodies of the animal mutilation, now flaunting sounds that we are completely buffaloed by for reasons unknown? Or this is it stretches the 2014 human mind a lot, but it definitely doesn't stretch quantum physics and what physicists have been writing about, and that is this. There have been people in the abduction syndrome and in the government who have said over the last 10 or 15 years that we are coming up against a point in time in which there will be an overlap of dimensions. Now, when I say overlap of dimensions, it's very, very hard for anybody who's human to get their minds around and grasp that. But it has been described in a particular case where this happens on a natural basis in this universe that we humans have not been conscious as a species long enough to know, and that when dimensions in a kind of warped cosmos overlap for a time, there can be all of these bizarre noises and booms and flashes of light and trans-dimensional, like if you're standing on a corner waiting for a bus, and you suddenly, to the people around you, you just disappear. It's because it is part of the phenomena of overlapping dimensions. And when you say that, I've had many people say, well, that's what in Revelations is called the where people would suddenly start disappearing around the planet. So how much of biblical literature, how much of science are sort of coming together here in this 21st century at a time where we might be moving into a section of the Milky Way galaxy that is interacting with another dimension in which extraterrestrials already know all about this, and that extraterrestrials have been coming and going on this planet for millions of years, one government guy told me, and that all of it has been outside the frame of reference or the experience of Homo sapiens sapien, which is modern human. And maybe we're going to get a dose of a whole other interaction with the universe around us that is actually natural, but not natural to us. And that if there are extraterrestrials who care about what happens to us, maybe all of this will provoke, finally, some honesty about the fact that we're not alone in the universe. I frankly think this entire planet needs to grow up. It needs to have the church leaders and the government leaders and the military people who keep a chokehold around people knowing that truth. I think that needs to be broken. I think the planet needs to be freed from those old mythologies in order for us to evolve and finally meet in a straightforward way some of the intelligences that have been using our planet for millennia. And the one sentence that I realized earlier in the interview that I didn't say and is a big part of all of this, genetic harvest is part of the animal mutilations, the human abductions, the taking of plants, taking of soil, taking of water. And a genetic harvest is something that extraterrestrials apparently have been doing on this planet for as long as they've been here. What we humans do not know is a genetic harvest by other intelligences from this planet and many other planets is being used how, by which ETs, for what reason. And that is what keeps me going in my work at earthfiles.com. Coast to Coast Radio, Dreamland Online Radio, Ancient Aliens Television, and so many others.
Well, Linda, I want to thank you so much for doing the show today. Earthfiles.com, everybody, is a place to go. And looks like Eureka Springs Ozark Conference is coming up April 11th through 13th, 2014, at the Best Western Inn of the Ozarks in Arkansas.
Yeah, and I'll be talking about my trip to Göbekli Tepe, which may actually have been made by extraterrestrials.
That's right. So anything else that you want to get out there besides the website and everything else?
I'll give my email address. Anybody listening who may have firsthand experiences you'd like me to know about, please email me at earthfiles@earthfiles.com. Always think of a reporter who files news about the Earth. So my email is earthfiles@earthfiles.com.
Earthfiles@earthfiles.com. You can be the 4,000th person to email her on any given day if you'd like to contact her there. And Linda, I want to thank you again so much for doing the show today. I know we had a time screw up and I called you late. I really apologize for that.
Listen, this has been great. You are very sharp, and I'm glad we were able to share this much with your audience.
All right. Thanks so much, and hopefully we can have you back again someday. We'll be back in just a moment, everybody, After Dark Radio on the Dark Matter Broadcasting Network.
Algo me hace pensar que todo fue tal como debía ser. Los esqueletos caminan alrededor. Yo avanzo con ellos, amor. En el oscuro laberinto del ayer, tus palabras se van, se hunden en el mar. En el oscuro laberinto del ayer, tus palabras se van, en el alba.
And we are back here live on the show, everybody. Brian Alvarez here, After Dark Radio on the Dark Matter Radio Network. What a night it's been. I apologize for the issues in the middle of that program as far as losing the connection. And in fact, if you recall earlier, when I opened up the phone lines and was getting no phone calls, guess what? 855, the toll-free number's down. That's right. It's awfully hard to get phone calls when the toll-free number is down. So here's what we're going to do. For the rest of the show, if you'd like to call in, open lines, I'm going to give you two phone numbers here, and I'm going to tweet them out as well. They are unfortunately not toll-free numbers. The toll-free line should be fixed as of tomorrow. But tonight, you can call these local numbers if you've got free long distance. If you've got a cell phone, you're welcome to call. They are 425-488-0525, or you can call 425-482-1686. Once again, those two numbers, 425-488-0525 or 425-482-1686. Those have now gone out on my Twitter, which you can check out at Brian Alvarez. And lo and behold, how that works. The phones are already ringing. So let's go to them. You are on the air. Who is this and where are you calling from?
Hi, this is Laura, and I'm calling from Texas.
Oh, Laura, what's going on?
Oh, I was just listening to the show and enjoyed listening to Linda. I've always been interested in listening to her talk about cattle mutilations, and I wanted to share a story about cattle mutilations with you tonight.
All right, let's hear it.
Well, I'm a former Protestant pastor, and this came from one of my parishioners in a small rural town in Texas, and I was visiting with them one day, and that's the reason I tell you that is I believe that they were telling me the truth. I don't think they'd make this up, you know, to tell their pastor. But they were telling me one day that they'd had a cattle mutilation at their place, and they described it to me, and it sounded a lot like what Linda was describing with the, and this was a pregnant cow, and the cow and the calf had been mutilated. But one of the things that they mentioned that I thought was really weird that I'd never heard Linda speak about before is that nothing would go near it.
Mm.
And I'm talking flies, vermin, nothing. And they believed it laid out there for about a day, but there wasn't a fly on the either one of the carcasses.
I
found that really creepy.
Yeah, I think I've heard her talking about that before, where
okay.
The animals nothing will go near it. And you know, obviously, people talk about well, maybe it's predators or whatever. But if you've got a dead carcass out there, and no predators, no flies, nothing. That's pretty weird.
That's really weird. And, you know, I can't think of anything that would explain that. The other thing they told me that I thought was really strange was that two of the family members, they were kind of like sitting around, it was like a evening or something like that, watching TV, and both two of the family members suddenly about the same time got almost like a feeling of having a heart attack, just almost like a panicky feeling.
Mm-hmm.
And when they put two and two together, they believe that it happened about the time the mutilation happened. And law enforcement basically said the same thing to them that Linda's heard, that, you know, there was nothing to explain it except things that they didn't want to speak about. And so anyway, I just wanted to throw that out there for anybody who, you know, might not be a believer, because I was a little bit skeptical too. I'm a former journalist, and I'd heard a lot about, you know, the theories about the satanic cults and cattle mutilation back in the early 80s. And I wasn't really sure that I believed the extraterrestrial angle. But after I heard that story from them, I began to believe. So if anybody out there doesn't believe it, the thing about the flies and then the thing that those people experienced, the physical experience that they had, really made me a believer.
So when they explained the whole situation to you, I mean, was it the same deal? There was no blood, the precision cuts. I mean, was it everything she's been talking about? Everything.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Wow.
And the fetus had been taken from the mother as well, and they'd left the fetus.
They'd left it.
Uh-huh.
Wow. Well, yeah, I want to thank you so much for the call. I really appreciate that. Yeah, thanks so much.
I really love your show. I really love it. I think it's great, and I'm so happy that Dark Matter is around, and, you know, we've got some alternatives to listen to than, you know, commercial radio that you know, your interview with Linda was really, really good. And I just wanted to say kudos to a great show. I look forward to it every week.
Well, thanks so much. I really appreciate that. And thanks so much for listening and supporting the Dark Matter Radio Network. And Linda was great. I thought Linda was great on the show. And the only thing I regret is I didn't have more time. So I'm hoping that down the road, maybe we can get her back on, maybe every couple of months. And I was alerted to getting Linda on just a couple of weeks ago. And I mean, she didn't give me a list of topics or anything. I gave her a call and it was like, whatever you want to talk about. And obviously, you know, as I noted at the beginning of the show, I could talk to Linda. I could ask her 8 million questions. And unfortunately, I only got 3 or 4 in because she had so much to say about everything. But I was glad I got in the question about the satanic cults, because I remember, you know, I'm 38 years old now. And I remember when I was a kid, you know, in the mid 80s, I mean, we always heard satanic cults are responsible for this, these, you know, all these stories, and, you know, kids tell these stories at school. And I always wondered about that, because you read about it. And a lot of times you'll hear that, oh, you know, these satanic cult stories, there's nothing to them. It was just kind of an urban legend. So it was very interesting to ask her about that. And hit her with something I don't think she gets asked about in a lot of interviews. So I was very happy about that. I thought she was awesome on the show, and hopefully we can have her back. If you want to give us a call, the phone numbers, as noted, they are up on my Twitter right now, 425-488-0525 is the phone number. Also, 425-482-1686. And I am attempting to get the 800 number fixed as we speak, but it's not going so well. It's always fun to try to do this kind of stuff as we are live on the air. By the way, I was asked this on Twitter. We're going to go a little long tonight just because of what happened. So if you want to give us a call, we'll have time here. Somebody asked about the beginning of the show. What is the bumper music? Where did I get it? That was actually created by one of the listeners. It was actually a buddy of mine. His name is Blizzard Beast, and he created that song from scratch. I've been doing the show for a while, and he kind of came forward and he goes, I do music. Would you like me to do something for After Dark? And I was like, sure, why not? And then he presented me with that, and I thought he'd gotten the music from somewhere and just kind of edited everything together. But no, he created the music. He did the whole thing. So for those of you asking where that song came from, that is an original from the Blizzard Beast. Did you guys get a chance to read the Mammoth article? It's up at on my Twitter, at Brian Alvarez. You can check it out at the New York Times. It's a very interesting article, actually. The Mammoth Cometh. And it's talking about the idea of... I'd actually never even heard this term before, but there is a term for this, and it is de-extinction. That's right. Someday your child may work for the Department of De-Extinction at a local wherever. But it's a very interesting article. They're talking about the idea of creating something called the Pleistocene Park in Siberia, which would involve mammoths. There'd be just a bunch of... exactly like Jurassic Park. That's where the name comes from, obviously. And this Pleistocene Park would be... they'd have a number of mammoths there. And it was interesting because the article is talking about this whole idea of de-extinction. And there's actually, like, you know, there are people creating lists, you know, lists. What should be, apparently my wife is listening in. She says it's Pleistocene. I must have pronounced that wrong. Pleistocene. She's trying to help me out here. Pleistocene. There we go. Pleistocene Park. My wife is much more intelligent than I am. Anyway, so the thing of creating this park, and obviously it's named after Jurassic Park. But what's interesting is they're doing this article here, and it's hilarious because they're talking about this whole process. And, you know, obviously we talked about earlier, it's going to be, you know, for a long time, it's going to be a very controversial deal. We're talking about bringing back extinct animals. And so this whole idea of de-extinction is going to, it's going to be very controversial. But it's talking about... it's talking about Jurassic Park, and it says here, this is a direct quote from this article. It says, thanks perhaps to Jurassic Park, popular sentiment is already behind this idea of de-extinction. And this guy here, Stuart Brand, tells the author of this article, and it says here, in all earnestness, quote, that movie has done a lot for de-extinction. Really? Jurassic Park? The whole story of the movie is dinosaurs come and they kill people. But apparently that movie is it's done a lot for this whole de-extinction thing. So I thought that was hilarious. Maybe people just heard about the movie but didn't actually watch it. Yeah, they bring back dinosaurs which proceed to kill everyone. I'm not sure how that's done a lot for de-extinction. But it does note here at the end of the article that when we talk about the process of this, and by the way, this is no easy process. This is not just an issue of, hey, we get some DNA, we bring back the passenger pigeon. It's significantly more difficult than that. There's a lot that goes into it. Not only do you have to actually bring this animal back, the passenger pigeon, for example, but as it notes here, you're not really bringing the animal back. It would be genetically extremely similar to the passenger pigeon, but you're not actually bringing back an extinct species. And they're talking here about how not only do you have to bring the thing back, but you've got to look at the way that the animal behaved, where it lived. Whatever animal is the mother and father of the first ever, reanimated or brought back from extinction, the passenger pigeon. I mean, this thing has got to be a mother to the passenger pigeon. And so they're talking about how, you know, the first step is the lab. And then the second step, you've got to go in there and you've got to deal with all of the other stuff. What's going on in the coop is basically what it said. So it's very interesting, but it does note at the end of the day, you're not really bringing back an actual passenger pigeon. You're not actually bringing back a real-life mammoth. And this guy here basically notes, you know, it may be what you end up getting may be closer to an African elephant with some more fur. So it's not like you're completely bringing back as it points out here, it would be passenger pigeon 2.0. Is it a real passenger pigeon or is it a persuasive imposter? So there you go, a synthetically created bird. It's an awesome article. It's up on my Twitter right now, which you can check out at Brian Alvarez. That is the Twitter. Also, I wish I had seen this last week, but I didn't because it just happened. But it would have been a great thing to talk to Seth Shostak about. This is from unexplained-mysteries.com, which is linked up on the AfterDarkRadioShow.com website. Double near miss as two asteroids pass the Earth. It says here, over the last couple of days, two large recently discovered asteroids have passed close to our planet. On Wednesday, a 100-foot space rock called 2014 DX-110 passed us by within the orbit of the moon at a distance of 217,000 miles. Astronomers had been able to see it coming, but with little in the way of warning, as it was only discovered on February 28th. February 28th it was discovered. And then one day later, there was a second smaller asteroid, 2014 EC, which passed us within a distance of 38,000 miles. At 33 feet across, this follow-up object was only discovered Tuesday. Yeah. It offered even less of a warning than Wednesday's. So it does note here that the asteroid, both of them in this case, would not have proven apocalyptic due to their relatively small size. However, as it notes here, two near misses in 2 days emphasizes how vulnerable we are to impacts from space. I was talking about this with Seth. I don't like the idea that we just discovered these asteroids like a week before they whizzed by the Earth. Within 214, this one here, 38,000 miles. A week earlier, we discovered it. I don't like when we discover something at the last minute, nor do I like, which happened last week, a couple of weeks ago, when something is on its way and everyone's getting ready to watch it, And then all of a sudden, it disappears. And we can't find it. That's not good. That's disturbing to me. So you can check that up there at AfterDarkRadioShow.com. And I also like this purported Sasquatch tracks found on Vancouver Island. What I wanted to ask Linda about, and I really hope we get her back on the show, I wanted to ask her about the weirdest things in Washington State, which is where I live. I mean, obviously we know about Bigfoot, and I've talked in the past about how we've got this place called the Maltby Cemetery, which is not really haunted. But when I went to school, the story was that somewhere in the cemetery, there were 13 steps. It was like I don't know what you'd call it, but in the middle of the cemetery, there were 13 steps down. It was called the 13 Steps to Hell. And the story was that if you were brave enough to go down there, when you got to about 11 or 12, you'd just book it out of there because of whatever was down there. And if you ever got to the 13th step, they'd never see you again. So that's a Maltby Cemetery. And, you know, local legends, that sort of thing. But I would like to know, what is the weirdest stuff that happens in Washington State? So if she comes back, I'm going to be selfish and I'm going to ask about where I live. So you can look forward to that. But this guy here, this is somewhere local, Vancouver Island. It's close by where I live. This fellow was this First Nations man, a young man, claimed he had a startling encounter with the beast. He says that he saw a mysterious figure crouching on the coast. He said something really big stood up, probably 8 or 9 feet tall. He said the first thing I had in mind was to get off the beach, I'll say. He says I pushed off as fast as I could and I got to deep water. My favorite part of this article, and you can go up to bc.ctvnews.ca. Maybe I'll tweet this out as well. But it's got a photograph of the footprint. The Bigfoot footprint. And apparently this creature was tromping around in the grass. And the funniest thing is you always know you need better evidence when you've got a picture of grass and somebody has taken like a white marker and they've just drawn around where you're supposed to see the footprint. Now to me, good footprint evidence is when you just look on the ground and, oh my God, look at that footprint. When you have to draw the line around where the footprint was, I don't know if that's a very good footprint. I'm also always skeptical when people find one footprint. You know, I don't think I've ever mentioned this before, but quickly before we wrap it up, I once went on an expedition with the BFRO. I've talked about this several times, but I completely forgot about this till right now. Probably because, as I've mentioned many times, when you're a skeptic and you see something weird, you kind of like, you explain it to yourself. You know what I mean? Whereas if I were a believer and I saw something, I'd never forget it because I would just be a believer. So I remember now that we were walking around and just kind of tromping around the woods. And I saw something that I swear to you looked like a giant Squatch footprint. And I took photos of it. And I went off on my way. And again, like I said, you know, I as a skeptic, I probably just ruled it out because it's kind of what I do. But it was interesting because it really did look like a footprint. But the reason that I ruled it out was that it was a lone footprint. If it's muddy around here and I walk through the mud, there's going to be a series of footprints. There wouldn't just be one footprint right in the middle. Unless I like dropped out of a helicopter and landed on one foot and then they picked me back up again, right? There would not be one footprint. There would be a series of footprints. So when I looked around the area of this footprint, there were no other footprints. So to me, it didn't matter how much this thing looked like a footprint. It can't be a Sasquatch footprint, right? Because there's only one. So this guy's photograph here on Vancouver Island, I don't know if it's, to me, the best evidence that he saw a Sasquatch, because it is one footprint out of the middle of nowhere that they had to draw with a white line around where you're supposed to see the footprint. Maybe the guy really saw something, I don't know. But that photograph right there from March 4th is not enough evidence for me. And with that, everybody, we are out of time. I want to thank you guys so much for joining us here today. Everybody knows where to go, the Dark Matter Radio Network. There's so much great stuff up there. There's shows up every single day, live shows, a lot of replays. There's a lot of great stuff up there. In fact, I can take a look here at everything that is coming up tomorrow on the Dark Matter Radio Network. Those shows will include Capricorn Radio, Dreamland is on the air at 7 p.m., the Astronomy Cast, Into the Planet at 8 o'clock p.m., and the Secret Teachings coming up at 9 p.m. So you can check that out. Of course, our show was preceded by Exploration and Fade to Black at 7 o'clock p.m., also Extreme Society Live at 5 o'clock p.m. The entire schedule is up at darkmatterradio.net. And if you've got a smartphone, what you need to do is you need to go to TuneIn Radio and download the TuneIn Radio app. You can put it on your phone. The stream is low bandwidth, and so you can play it pretty much anywhere you want over your cell service. You can hook it up in your car if you've got an auxiliary audio cable, or if you've got Bluetooth, for example, which I've got in my car, which is just the greatest thing ever to have Bluetooth in your car. You can essentially listen to the Dark Matter Radio Network no matter where you are in the world with internet. You can listen to it in your car. Or wherever you are in the world with internet, you can listen to the Dark Matter Radio Network. It doesn't matter if there's a local radio station. It doesn't matter where you are. If you have internet, you can listen to the Dark Matter Radio Network. So head up to TuneIn Radio and check that out. I don't make any money off TuneIn Radio. Hopefully someday there's a giant windfall coming from TuneIn. But right now I don't make anything. I'm just telling you, it is an awesome thing. So check out TuneIn Radio. ArtBell.com, of course, is the place to go. Our illustrious webmaster, Keith Rowland, runs that. So make sure you check out artbell.com. Of course, on Facebook, you can follow us, After Dark Radio Show. My buddy Andrew does an awesome job on the Facebook page. So just search After Dark Radio Show, and there you go. Dark Matter's got a Facebook page as well. So make sure you head up there and check that out. And finally, of course, check out the After Dark Radio website, which is up at afterdarkradioshow.com. Within about 20 minutes, the show is going to be up there and available at afterdarkradioshow.com for a free download. It'll be up there for a week. So if you're listening right now, if I were you, if you haven't heard it yet, I would head up right now and download the Seth Shostak interview, because as soon as this show goes up, that one's gone. You can only get it if you're a subscriber at our other website, WrestlingObserver.com. So go up there and get it for free right now. And then this program is going to be up in about 20 minutes. And regardless of the glitches that we had when we were booted off the air earlier on in the program, the complete show, uncut, you'll never even know anything happened, is going to be up there on the website. So again, I apologize for the technical issues tonight. The phone line should be fixed for next week. And thanks again, everybody, for listening here tonight. Of course, thanks to Keith Rowland, the man behind all of this, and Art Bell as well, the great Art Bell. We shall be back next week with a brand new show, and we'll talk to you again very soon.
Getting late on a sunny evening, poor Lightning gotta go home and take him some rest. Getting late on a sunny evening, poor Lightning gotta go home and take some rest. You know I got to pick cotton tomorrow and Monday. Little girl, you know that's gonna be a solid mess.